This is an iHeart podcast.
This is Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6.
I love quotes. We're going to talk about America, manufacturing, how do we get it back here tonight, but I want to talk about a quote I love first. And oddly, we're going to go overseas for this quote. Isn't that weird for an America First special? Yamamoto, you've heard of him. Yamamoto, the Japanese admiral who was the author of the Pearl Harbor invention. Well, the Pearl Harbor invasion invention. The Pearl Harbor invasion. He's the one who came up with this quote. And I think about this quote a lot as I look at America now. You see, when we think back on things like Pearl Harbor and World War II, we're proud, aren't we? We're very proud of what our country was able to do, what our boys in uniform were able to do. But do you want to know why we won World War II? On top of all that bravery, do you want to know why we won World War II? Well, don't take it from me. Take it from Yamamoto. Quote, "Anyone who has seen the auto factories in Detroit and the oil fields in Texas knows that Japan lacks the national power for a naval race with America." The truth is this. Oh, all that blood and guts out there and the troops, yeah, no question about it. They were the tip of the spear. But when we look back on things like that, we won World War II in the manufacturing plants, churning out tank after tank after tank, bomb after bomb, bullet after bullet, rifle after rifle, over and over and over again, while other modern nations simply had their equipment shatter, their food run out. America's manufacturing giant arm awoken and simply turned on the juice, and we overpowered everybody on the manufacturing line. Fast forward to where we are now. When's the last time you took a drive, or maybe you actually live in it, through the Rust Belt? See, I was born there. And there are so many towns across the United States of America that used to be bustling Rust Belt towns, manufacturing towns. One of those towns where everybody is tied in some way to the local steel mill. The kids get new shoes on their feet every single school year because of the steel mill. The wife gets pretty diamond earrings at Christmas time because of the steel mill. And those things are gone. They're gone, and instead we have a drugged out, listless Rust Belt now because the elites in this country sent all of our jobs over to China. And I hate it. I want them back. How do we get them back? We've given China all this power over us. God forbid we have another world war. All those tanks and planes won't be coming out of our factories because the factories are gone. But that aside, how do we get back to having American jobs in this country? Can we? Is it even possible? Well, I promise you we're going to dig into that tonight. It's going to be fun, all right? Now, I do want to make sure that I do this over and over and over and over again. We talk on the show about putting our money where our morals are. I will tell you, for the longest time, I did not do this. I didn't care about made in America. But I don't care. Just give me whatever's cheapest. You've probably done that too. Don't feel bad about it, but I want to change that. When I talk to you about Grip 6, it's more than the quality. I know you already know about the wallets. Everyone knows about the wallets. By the way, this is RFID blocking, meaning those thieves can't do that little scanner thing where they get your credit card just walking up to you. They can do that to you, not to me. My card's locked in. You know about the wallets. You know about the belts. No more little notches in the belt. Fully adjustable. Whatever's perfect for your waist. Best belts ever. You know about the socks. Wool socks that don't itch. They're good in the summer. I live in Houston and I wear wool socks in the summer. That's how good Grip 6 socks are. But you know what? Forget about that. Forget about that. Made in America. Grip 6 makes it a priority. Made in America. A lot of their stuff is not just made in America, it's made in-house by Americans. That's why I love Grip 6. Go support an American company and get the coolest wallet ever, most comfortable socks ever, best belt. Grip6.com/Jesse. All right? Grip6.com/Jesse. We'll be back.
You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6. You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6.
I wrote in 2015 the book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, and I mentioned 23 or 24 technologies which will change the world. Our life in 10 years from now will be completely different, very much affected, and who masters those technologies in some way will be the master of the world.
Master of the world? Huh. That's an interesting aspiration. Joining me now, Patrick Newman, fellow of the Mises Institute. Okay, Patrick, that doesn't sound like he has America's best interests at heart, but maybe I just heard him wrong.
Certainly he's looking for more of a globalist perspective where the United States is kind of subservient to broader, more worldwide interests. Of course, these interests are a small elite that's really running the show in various countries.
Okay, but he's talking a lot about the fourth industrial revolution and things like that, but this stuff goes beyond many people. Many people are educated in America's education system, books. We won't go into the details. Why don't you act like I just got here from another planet and tell me what the first industrial revolution was?
Sure. So the first industrial revolution initially started in Great Britain, then it was in the United States. This was really late 1700s, early 1800s, up until about the 1830s, a period of massive change. You saw a movement away from hand processes and craftsmen to interchangeable parts. This was the rise of the steam engine, so actually creating machines to power things aside from being powered by animals or humans or water. You saw the rise of iron manufacturing and also mass-produced clothes, or the textile industries it was called, basically making clothes through wool and cotton. You saw the rise of chemicals being manufactured, particularly sodium carbonate and various other type of chemicals used in glass and soap and so on. So this is a really big change that happened in the early 1800s that really revolutionized human society.
Okay, the second one, what was it?
Well, the second one took place about 40 years later, really started in the 1850s and then continued throughout the rest of the decade. And you saw a bit more technology and more advanced manufacturing. We now see the railroads being utilized, right? So the railroads are being developed. This is how people are traveling across the continent of the United States, the rise of electrical power. You see petroleum, so people are using oil or kerosene to light lamps, then they're using it to power automobiles. That become a big thing in the early 1900s, 1920s, thinking Henry Ford and General Motors and so on. This is really the beginning of sort of the modern economic society with mass-produced consumer products, as well as a lot of the things we take for granted, such as toilets, sewage, electricity, as I've mentioned, plumbing, and so on.
Okay, I'm sure you guessed where I'm going next. The third, what was it before we get to his desired fourth?
Yeah, well, the third industrial revolution, this really picked up after World War II, and this is really the digital age, right? So this is the rise of processing machines. So you see computer chips, computers. Of course, we think of computers as being the more modern computer we all know, but these really had started off in the even in the 70s and 80s. So you saw the rise of, again, computers, video game consoles, digital cameras, so on. So this is really when more and more things are being processed and sorted through a electronic machine, and we are able to communicate with each other electronically. Of course, the major culmination of this at the beginning of the 20th century in the late at the beginning of the 21st century was, of course, the internet.
All right. Now, why is the fourth one bad? Because you hear Bond movie villains like Klaus Schwab talk about the fourth one, and you think, man, that's got to be terrible, and whatever that guy wants must be bad. Is it bad?
Well, there's certainly the fourth industrial revolution, like the other industrial revolutions, can provide a lot of things to make people better off. But of course, in the wrong hands or with the various government policies, it can make things the lives of many people worse off. The big thing we could say here with the industrial revolution, the fourth industrial revolution, is the rise of AI, artificial intelligence, and how artificial intelligence will be used. And of course, wrapped up with this concept of a fourth industrial revolution is how are we going to power things, right? In the first and second and third industrial revolutions, we powered machines, we powered society through, I guess you could say, with various pollutants, the not green technology. So tied in with this fourth industrial revolution is supposed to be this this total overhaul of how we power society through various green technologies and so on, and how this will interact with artificial intelligence. And there's going to be the government's going to have a lot more control over people's lives and being able to monitor what exactly they're doing, as well as how to shape them to engage in certain activities.
Okay, how are we going to power things? And I ask this because it seems like the forces around the world, governments around the world, are attempting to force a transition from our current power sources that work into ones that simply don't provide enough power yet. You can't shut down a coal plant and just put up solar panels. That's not how it works. The solar panels don't produce enough juice. Are we forcing it? Are we going to hurt ourselves by trying to force something?
I'm of the opinion, and I think the evidence backs this up, that forcing these types of technologies or these so-called green technologies, solar panel, even a move to more electric cars, and not using gasoline and coal and other sorts of quote-unquote pollutants, this is going to hurt us. Of course, it will help the companies that are producing those, that are getting various subsidies from the government. It, of course, will help other countries that are trying to get a leg up. And really, the main result of this is that in order to industrialize other parts of the world with these new technologies and with these new methods of power, we are going to, the United States is going to have to get hurt. So this is, it's going to create a lot of upheaval. It's going to enrich certain businesses and government officials that are involved in this kind of environmental racket, I might say, and it's going to could really hurt human living standards.
Can we bring manufacturing back here, Patrick, or is it gone forever? I know we've shipped so much of it overseas. We want to control some of our supply chain, obviously, especially the critical parts. But is it possible, or is that a pipe dream and we're just a globalist world now and that's just the way it is?
I think it's possible to bring back certain types of manufacturing. We have to think about why did certain manufacturing companies leave the United States. Some of this is just comparative advantage. Certain countries have access to better raw materials, or they have cheaper labor, they have more favorable regulations, et cetera. Other reasons is inflicted by the government policies. So we can have stronger labor standards, OSHA. We have stronger environmental standards. I'm thinking of the EPA. For the longest time, we had the highest corporate income tax rate in the world, at least the statutory rate. And even with various exemptions and so on, it was still very high. And these discouraged various companies from continuing to produce in the United States and encouraged them to move to China, to move to Southeast Asia, other parts of the world and so on. And in those types of industries, we should certainly try to encourage back by getting rid of taxes and regulations that discourage entrepreneurs in America from setting up businesses in the country.
Patrick, I appreciate you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
My buddy Ross Kennedy joins us next. He knows more about supply chains than anybody, so I'm going to ask him some questions about that. Let's get a little bit smarter. You ready for that? Hang on.
You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6. You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6.
10 years ago, how many of you knew what the hell a supply chain was? No, I'm serious.
You know, everybody made fun of Joe Biden for that, but I remember the beginning of COVID when 15 days to slow the spread was initially proposed. I remember this, Fauci and Trump up there, hey, just 15 days. And I remember sitting there screaming at everybody, do you understand how supply chains work? And everybody told me to shut up, that I wanted grandma to die and that we could just pick up the remote control and just unpause the economy after we pause it. I remember this like it was yesterday. So maybe Joe Biden accidentally stumbled into something legitimate. Maybe people really do not understand how supply chains work. So let's bring in the expert, my buddy Ross Kennedy, Fortis analysis and also a supply chain expert and national security expert. Ross, okay, this is going to be the ultimate dumb down for a guy like you, but pretend like I've been educated in America's education system. I therefore know nothing about supply chains in the business world. What's a supply chain?
Well, I mean, essentially, it's just all the different things and partners that come together to make another thing. If you're talking about Legos, you know, the people that would be making the plastic material that the Legos are formed from, the people that are making the machines that actually mold the Legos. You know, if a physical thing is being made and transported, or in some cases, the software and design elements of a complex thing, that all constitutes a supply chain. So it's just how a thing gets made and moves to another place to be eventually consumed, whether it's by a business or by a consumer.
Ross, how does this work when we bring in other countries? And this is the part of it that gets so convoluted, even in my mind, and I understand supply chains because, okay, I've got to make my Legos, but in order to make the plastic or whatever it is to make the Legos, I need this special ingredient from Nepal, but I also need another ingredient from the Philippines. But wait, the government just changed its policies. There's an extra tax on what it's from. You see what I mean? It gets so confusing when you make it international, does it not?
Yeah, it does. It's we went international. Globalism became the dominant way. It became the default mode for the Harvard MBAs of the world in the 80s and the 90s, because at the end of the day, it was all about getting to the lowest cost per unit. Now, whatever that widget is that you're making, you want to make it as cheaply as possible, of course, and sell it for as much as you possibly can. And so what you saw happening was that manufacturers and suppliers began to co-locate their manufacturing at the cheapest place they could purchase and then combine and assemble all of the goods. Usually the limiting factor was going to be energy costs, labor costs, or regulations. So in the U.S., as we began to implement more expansive regulatory reform related to the Clean Water Act, Clean Air, as our energy got more expensive, as it became more difficult and expensive to hire people to make chemicals, whatever it may be, places like China stepped up to fill the gap because they were very cheap for labor. They obviously didn't care much about the environment. And then what built up around that was a transportation method, or, you know, transportation supply chain element, which was, how do we get the things we're making over there to here? And then you begin to see the ocean carriers begin to drive their own costs down, and the rise of containerization made it so that things could be made and transported to and made in one place, and then the finished product transported here to be consumed. So at the end of the day, generally the more expensive or difficult it is to make a thing, the less likely a given government is going to be, you know, supporting the manufacturing of those things.
Globalism, when it comes to an economy, is it bad? Is it all bad? Or is some of it good? What's the Ross analysis?
The more you can control the things that you desperately need, you know, the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, if you will, food, water, energy, shelter, clothing, the better off you are. Globalism gets, I guess, more useful if you're looking at luxury goods, or if you're talking about things that are nice to haves, not need to haves. But in the case of the United States, so many things that we desperately need that would be a leash or handcuffs on us, or a way to control us if those things were to go missing or were to be cut off. We are far too dependent on global sources for that. So it's not even that they're made in a neighboring country that's friendly. There are a lot of these things are being made in distant countries that rely on very fragile modes of transportation that can get very expensive in a hurry. And they're being made in countries like China and Russia that are adversarial to U.S. interests. So in that case, globalism extremely bad. And then before we even, you know, tackle the question of to what extent is globalism good, We should probably at least be able to take care of ourselves and then worry about the bigger picture.
You mentioned China a couple minutes ago when we were talking about things being made there and how much cheaper labor is. I'm scared to even ask the question, but Ross, how much does slave labor come into play when we deal with the things that we buy in this country?
Far more than we'd like to admit to ourselves, if nothing else. It's not just in Xinjiang involving the Uyghurs, though, of course, that's the issue that's gotten a lot of shine in the last few years. But if you look at China's dominance in the rare earth metals industry, if you look at their dominance in various forms of high-end manufacturing even, if you look at their dominance in textiles, if you take all of these things together, the one common link is that many of the large production centers for them come from areas or the supply chains for those industries begin in some of the far-flung distant provinces of China where they do absolutely utilize forced labor. But it's not just in those provinces where manufacturing is a problem. It's the coal that gets dug out of the ground all over the country to power their various factories, endemic with prison labor, forced labor. The other one, anytime you see poverty alleviation programs where a company or a Chinese province says, oh, we participate in poverty alleviation, that's code for internal migrant trafficking. And what they're doing is they're taking very poor people and conscripting them into incredibly low-paid, slave-like conditions, moving them from one province to another and forcing them to make things, you know, in some factory that's 1,000 miles from their home and families.
Is this something we need to be more proactive about as a nation, Ross, in all seriousness? I'm not even picking political parties here. Or is this just kind of how it is? The second you start taking things from other countries, you're going to have slave labor as part of your economy.
Sure it is. And it's not just China. It's in the Congo. You know, very famously, they utilize artisanal mining as a way, if you will, but which just essentially means, a mom with a baby on her back and a pickaxe, you know, smacking at the rock. These types of things are all over the world. It is that way, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are a lot of ways that we can decouple ourselves from these types of situations and we can get more aggressive about pursuing human rights and the bottom line. There doesn't have to be a tension between them. In the U.S., we've used utilized UFLPA, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, and a recent discussion I was having with some high-level Customs and Border Protection officials who is one of the regulating agencies in enforcing that act. There's 78,000 companies right now under active investigation, either Chinese entities or U.S. entities that are suspected of being involved and are having shipments detained and investigated under UFLPA. So we're not doing nothing about it. It's certainly the most aggressive that we've ever been in trying to enforce this, but there's a huge amount of work to be done, and we're not seeing the amount of reshoring activity yet that one might suspect they would be if, you know, they're importing from China and getting their shipments detained for suspension of the act. They're kind of just waiting it out or setting up new companies and trying to bypass or get the goods in through Canada or Mexico or some other way.
Ross, thank you, my brother. Come back soon.
Thank you, Jesse.
You know, I talk to you a lot about Grip 6. And what do I do? I pull out the wallets because everyone loves the wallets. This these cool little card holders. And yeah, my cards lock in. You've seen it 100 times. I'm not even going to do it. I've talked to you about the belts. I've talked to you about the socks. I've talked to you about the quality of everything. That's not really what appeals the most to me about it. I love that it's all American-made. American-made. And I'll tell you, to my shame, I never used to place a big priority in that when I was younger. In fact, when I'd have an old timer say, buy American, sometimes I'd roll my eyes. Okay, buddy, I'm going to go with what's cheaper. And those days are past. We need to make American made, the American worker, American quality, the lack of American slave labor a priority. I love that about Grip 6. I do. To be honest with you, full disclosure, I would probably buy their socks if they weren't even that great because they're made in America. Now, they happen to be the best freaking socks ever, the best belt ever. You already know about the wallet, but I love that. Praise the boys of Grip 6 for that, for sure. And I love that they have new stuff coming, too. By the way, if you want a wallet, and you should, or socks or a belt, whatever they make, made in America. That's putting your money where your morals are. Go to grip6.com/Jesse, all right? They give you a special discount out there. grip6.com/Jesse. We'll be back.
You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6. You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6.
Where in the hell is it written that says America can't lead the world in manufacturing again? Where is that written? I don't know where it's written. And it's not going to be on my watch. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm getting criticized internationally for my maybe focusing too much on America. The hell with that.
Who's saying that? Where is it written? Where is it? You know what? Joining me now, John Carney, Breitbart News, Finance and Economics Editor. John, I hate to interrupt the president when he's having conversations with himself, but what has Joe Biden actually done to bring manufacturing back here? Because I, having grown up in the Midwest, I know what's happened to the Rust Belt. Where did our manufacturing go and what's he done to fix it?
Well, first of all, yes, our manufacturing went to China. The whole world sent their manufacturing to China. He hasn't done anything to fix it, except surprisingly, he has not repealed the Trump tariffs. People scream that these were going to destroy the economy, you know, cause inflation, do all this stuff when Trump put them in place. But we now see that that was all Trump derangement syndrome because Biden's kept almost all of the tariffs in place. And, you know, the world keeps going on and people don't even notice it anymore.
Okay. Did they help? I'd always kept them in place. Did they help? What did they do? Should we be doing more of it?
Yeah, they helped a little bit, but not very much. We need to do a lot more. One of the things we found out during the pandemic is how dependent we are on China. When China locked down its manufacturing cities, there was a lot of things we just couldn't get in the United States. Things that that are mostly made in America often have Chinese components to them. And so when China wasn't shipping us that stuff, we couldn't do it. We couldn't make it. Toy companies were, you know, people wanted to buy toys for their kids because their kids' schools were locked down and you couldn't get toys because all the toys came from China. We probably need a lot stronger of a trade barrier to prevent China from, you know, running roughshod over us. And frankly, the trade deficit with China is rising very rapidly. So whatever we've done, it just isn't enough yet.
John, beyond tariffs, which I don't even know how I feel about tariffs, it's just that it doesn't ever seem to work out the way it looks like it's going to work out. But beyond those, whatever we feel about them, how do we start making more things here again? And I'm not naive. I know it's not the year 1800. I know that it's a global economy and that's the way it is. But I would like it if a Midwest Rust Belt town could have a couple steel mills and have people earning good wages and have a good life.
It's pretty insane. We used to be one of the greatest furniture makers in the world, the United States. Yeah. We produced lots of furniture. I was recently trying to buy a kitchen table, and trying to find one made domestically was really difficult. I could not find furniture made in America. Why is that? How can it make sense that, you know, my kitchen chairs come from China? Like that seems a long way. Why aren't they coming from Tennessee or Ohio? We used to have a huge furniture manufacturing base here and we don't anymore. We gave it up.
Can we get it back? Because I realize it's the labor thing. I'm not naive. I used to work for my family business. I know when Dad looked at the profit loss sheet, it was always the labor market that was never a good mark. And so companies are always trying to reduce that mark, reduce that number. Okay, well, we can't start having slaves here in America. I don't think anybody would prefer that, Lord willing. So China does, we don't. How do we compete with people who have slave labor?
Yeah, basically what we need to do is just have a rule that we're not buying stuff from China. I mean, I don't think a numerical tariff can be high enough to justify buying stuff from countries that have slave labor. So I would say no, you know, nothing from China. That should be the rule. It'll take some time to get there, though, because over the last 23 years, we've become incredibly dependent on China, and we can rebuild American manufacturing. Heck, we don't even just have to rebuild American manufacturing. If we just took half the jobs we exported to China to enrich China's peasantry and put those in Central America, that would go a long way to solving our border crisis. People are, one of the reasons that our neighbors to the south have remained so poor is that many of the jobs that that economists 25 years ago assumed would be migrating into Mexico and from Mexico south from there actually all ended up in China. So yes, American manufacturing has been devastated by China, but so has Central and South America. The jobs that would normally, you know, they would be exporting stuff to us ended up all going to China.
Okay, that's very interesting to think about. So is that one of the things, because this has always been a frustration for me. I realize we're getting sidetracked. We're supposed to be talking about Made in America, but whatever. One of the things that's always frustrated me is the condition of Mexico. It's such a disaster, and it shouldn't be. I just love it. I love the people. I love the vacation there. I love the beer. I love the music. I love the food. They have great natural resources. They have two oceans. I look at Mexico, and I think this should be a superpower, and instead they suck. Why?
I do think China played a big role. When we put in place NAFTA in 1995, this was going to be a huge opportunity for Mexico. Instead, a few years later, we allowed China into the WTO. China took all the jobs. If I were a Mexican, I would be very upset at the way China basically was a predator on the Mexican economy. Jobs that would have been being done in Mexico are now being done in China. I think we can reverse that process, though. I don't think it's too late. You know, just because we're buying so much from China now doesn't mean 10 years from now we have to keep doing that. And in fact, I don't think we can keep doing it. I think the change is inevitable, and we need some politicians who will actually start to put policies in place to make this happen.
Is there any willpower for that, though, John, when it comes to our politicians? Because, look, we talk about Trump, and I'm grateful that we have a more America-first GOP, more America-first-focused GOP right now. They have a long way to go. But it still seems like this has been a both-party thing of just, hey, American manufacturing doesn't matter, screw it. It seems like we're a million miles away from reversing that. But are we closer than I'm selling it?
No, we are pretty far away. You're right that the exporting jobs was popular with both parties. I think, though, that Americans saw, but 20 years ago when Pat Buchanan was warning us that this was going to happen, people said, oh, he's fear-mongering, you know, the jobs aren't really all going to go to China. This, you know, now we can look back and we say, okay, we didn't get the bargain we were sold. We didn't get advanced manufacturing jobs while we sent the, you know, the primitive ones off to foreign land. In fact, we just wiped out entire communities throughout the American Midwest. So we can undo that. We don't have to keep the policies in place that allowed this to happen. It is within our power to change our policies.
All right. John, who needs who more? I wrestle with this, and I should have just called you because you're the smart one. Who needs who more, us or China? And I think about this because, look, we are competitors, but we somehow need each other. We're competitors, but we're married. There's scary things going on right now in the world. So let's say, God forbid, World War III kicks off here. Who is going to be in more trouble?
I think, so China needs our market. They do not have enough of a domestic demand economy to support all the jobs that they have in China. So they need us. But I think they could get by for a few years without us. We can't get by without China. We have become dangerously dependent on China. If China decided, you know what, we don't like the way you're treating Russia, we're going to put economic sanctions on you and not sell you anything for 2 years, we would be in a lot of trouble. We are too dependent on them. We need to wean ourselves from that dependency. And frankly, I don't really, you know, we had Trump and he talked a good game, but even his policies didn't go far enough. And so we're going to need something even stronger than that.
All right. John Carney, thanks, brother. Come back soon. The Grip Six boys. We want to talk about American manufacturing. Well, the boys from Grip 6 join us next.
You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6. You're watching Outsourced, America's Manufacturing Crisis, built by Grip 6.
I've been obsessed with belts for a long time. I wear a belt every day, and there was like three things that always drove me crazy about belts. You have all these holes, but you only use one of them. This big flap hanging off the front, and it usually sticks out under your shirt. And so I'd search high and low for a belt that would like not do any of those things, and I couldn't find it. There's enough things in life that are super complicated, and I like to simplify things down. As an engineer, I thought, it'd be fun to try to design something myself that would actually be able to do that. So the belt's really cool because it solves those exact three problems. There's no holes, there's no flap, and it's super flat, like low profile. When you put it on, it doesn't stick out under your shirt, it ends up being super comfortable, and it's just extremely simple. We make our products right here in the USA. The webbing's a military webbing that we have custom made for us. It's rated at like 3,000 pounds. It's got just a ton of strength. The buckle that goes with it is an aerospace grade aluminum, and we actually make them ourselves, like in our shop. The strap and the buckle come apart super easy, and you can mix and match anything that you want. So you can make like 45 combinations. We have a ton of confidence in our product because we wear it every day. And we know that people that buy it absolutely love it. And so we're more than happy to say, just give it a shot, because if you don't love it, we'll totally give you a refund, no problem.
You know how I knew I was getting old? When I started to prioritize things like my socks and my belt, and I started complaining about my wallet. And that's what I knew. And now when you improve on those things, you find actually the quality of your life is better. My Grip 6 belt doesn't pinch me. And the little fat thing I have right here on the hip. Joining me now, BJ Minson, the founder of Grip 6, and David Burton, general counsel, director of marketing at Grip 6. Okay, BJ, the belt itself, let's just set aside everything else. Why did it take so long to find a belt, for me to find a belt that didn't have the holes? It's the hole thing that's the problem for me, because they all look gnarled like that. Every single one of them does, and it drives me absolutely up the wall. This is the only belt I've ever seen like this.
Yeah. I'm not sure why it took a long time for that belt to come out. I hated the belt with holes for a long time, and so I used to wear one of David's military belts, and it was much better, but it still was really bulky. So it was kind of like, how could you make a belt that's like the military belt and doesn't have the holes but isn't so bulky? And that's kind of how I came up with the belt.
David, made in America. I've in the past, just doing stupid T-shirt ideas or various other dumb things I do on this show, I've looked at things like this, and it's so hard to find good stuff that is made in America. Or if you find it, it's super expensive. Yet, and that's what we've been talking about a lot tonight, yet you were able to do it. You guys were able to put together outstanding products that don't break the bank, made in America. I don't want you to give away all the trade secrets, but how'd you do it?
You know, I think when we started Grip 6, we had this idea that we didn't want to just be a business that was successful. We wanted to be a business that helped change a little bit, for the better in America. And so kind of like our underlying mission is to affect manufacturing. And the only way we can do that is to make products that are that we can do in scale. We can do mass quantities, and we can do them really high quality. They're innovative, and that they don't break the bank. And so as we go through things, or we price things out, we're really pricing as low as we can, and looking at getting as much manufacturing experience as we can as well. And so I guess the answer is, if you have that as an idea going forward, you push to that, you put your energy into it, you can be successful at it.
Manufacturing in America, people complain rightfully so about it leaving our shores, and it has left our shores, sadly, for decades. Since you are both knee-deep in this, David, I guess I'll stick with you for this one. Can we bring it back? You've been successful. You built this great company. Everyone's thrilled with everything. I get emails every single day. Jesse, the socks. Jesse, my wallet. But is this something on a larger scale that we as Americans can do? Can we bring it back?
Look, Jesse, it's not just that we can do it, we have to do it, right? I mean, manufacturing is the backbone of any economy, and especially for America. You know, you're looking at America 50 years ago or so, and we were the kings of manufacturing in the whole world. So a lot of our economic success was built on the backbone of manufacturing, and the loss of manufacturing to us has been devastating. And maybe we don't feel it right now, but we will feel it in the future when we've lost the expertise and the knowledge, skills, and abilities that we really have to have to be a strong economy. So as manufacturing overseas, we lose control of it, and that means to some degree we lose control of the economy. And so we believe in a free market and global trade, but an understanding of the importance of things being made by us, right, is critical for Americans to regain. And the ability to do it again is to have the pride in it ourselves, in not just making products, but products that last a really long time, that are, like I said before, innovative. And we give everything, for example, Grip 6, a lifetime warranty, to make sure that we can test ourselves and making sure that we're following in line with our own values and principles. But the key to the future of American manufacturing is, in our opinion, we've spent a lot of time thinking and discussing and moving in this direction, is modernizing manufacturing and being nimble, using automation and robotics and technology to be competitive. We can never be competitive with China or India for labor prices, for example, but we can be more than competitive with technology and innovation, which is what our strength is currently in any case. So I think that manufacturing in America, we have to rethink what it looks like. It looks nimble. It doesn't look like the old boy system of manufacturing 100 years ago. And as we accept that, and it looks really cool, modern American manufacturing is, and it looks great. And I can say, working at Grip 6, it's something that is super fulfilling. So as we rebuild the American kind of manufacturing in several industries, not only is it really essential for economy, but it's also rather fulfilling for the people that work in it. We get a lot of technical jobs, technical labor, engineering and machining and problem solving skills that will help us for many years to come.
BJ, I'm actually glad the founder himself is here, because I have to ask you a question. There's currently a war going on within the Kelly household. You see, everyone knows that this is my Grip 6 wallet, that I've held it up in front of the camera 8,000 times. This is my Grip 6 wallet. I wanted to try one without the loop. I now have this wallet, and where my cards, as you can see, currently are. By the way, cards not falling out until I want them to. My youngest son is outraged that I have dropped the American flag and gone with one that did not have the American flag. I explained I wanted one without a loop. I'll give it up to the founder. Your call.
So what's your question as far as loop or no loop?
Loop or no loop, which wallet? Do I go American flag with the loop or straight black?
I love the American flag, obviously, and I'm a loop guy myself. The loop is super nice to be able to grab something, pull it out, play with it a little bit, use your cards, and you don't risk dropping it because you have such a firm hold on it. So I'm a loop guy myself. I would go with the loop.
BJ, David, Grip 6. Okay, each of you, 30 seconds. David, we'll start with you. Grip 6, what's the next product you want? Don't tell me you're going to stop at belts, socks, and wallets, because you already make the three best things in the country. What's the next one? Give it to me.
I think we're going to jump out and go into something that's not an accessory. So pickleball paddles. We're also working on disc golf discs. And the call that we keep getting is for wool hoodies and wool sweaters. So that's my desire, is to go in that route. We need to build out more machines and get our technical expertise and manufacturing expertise into that. And I could see that within a year happening.
BJ?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it internally. I would just echo what David said. We've got the pickleball paddles, which we're actually very close to and will probably happen by this summer. And then we kind of want to get out of like the accessory thing and kind of into to some bigger markets. And obviously that requires bigger manufacturing, and that's something that we're always happy to do. So yeah, we're always kind of looking for the next thing.
You guys have no idea how angry my wife is going to be that you're coming up with hoodies now. Hoodies are my favorite thing in the world. I think I have like 20 of them, and now I'm going to have Grip 6 hoodies on top of it. And pretty prolific frisbee golfer. We called it Falf back in the day. BJ, David, thank you both so much, man. I love you guys. You know I do.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jesse.
Of course. Grip 6 boys. Made in America. Talk about putting your money where your morals are. There it is right there, all right? All right. Now, let me talk about this for just a brief moment. Made in America matters. We try to make sure we will bring you products as often as we can that are made in America. Now, what responsibility do you and I have? Let's patronize those businesses, right? Wherever you can find it, patronize those businesses. Next time you need some socks, a belt, wallet, you know where to go.
This is an iHeart podcast.